shoe was lodged in the door. It was like we were being herded. Looks like we have to find another way out. We limped our way across the concrete landing where I pulled open the door to the main part of the building, the wisps of propane gas following us. I was careful to kick Albert's shoe out of the way. The lights were off in the main hallway, but the corner of the building where human services resided was lit up like Christmas. I sighed. Any ideas? He tried to stand, but I could feel that he still needed support. We can try toward the back. We turned and started down the main hallway that ran the length of the building. Just out of curiosity, were the junction cords that had been tapped into from human services? Yes. How many people know that that system exists? He stumbled in his attempt to get his feet underneath him.
Hardly anybody. Nobody goes into that basement. You'd have to be an old-timer, like me.
I thought about old-timers, red foxes and medical bracelets, and finally scratched that itch that had been bothering me. I turned to help Albert again, and when I did, I saw a familiar outline silhouetted by the exit lights near the center of the building. He was even wearing the hat and was leaning on the security desk, an unopened bottle of wild turkey sitting on top of the sign-in ledger. I stopped and watched as he stepped into the center of the hallway and faced us, his hands clutched together. "Fancy meeting you here, Herbert." He paused. "Hi, Sheriff." He pulled the unlit cigar from his mouth, and his voice was desolate and removed. "I thought I'd better clean up before you guys found out what I'd done." He exhausted a sad laugh and shook his head. "It's all so messed up." "You killed her?" The response was choked in his throat, crowded there along with his heart.
"No. No, I didn't."
"She fell?"
"I was trying to talk to her, but she backed up and lost her balance. I tried to get to her, but she fell."
His head jerked around in an attempt to find a way out of a place with no emotional exits.
"I wouldn't have tried to kill my own child."
"So, Adrian's yours?"
"Yes."
He took a step forward, and I could see his face beneath the brim of the gray top hat, the eagle feather forward. It was at that moment I saw that he had put the cigar back in his mouth and was holding the old combat-cut brass-covered Zippo lighter in his hand. I started to speak but coughed with a whiff of the heavy gas. "I don't suppose you'd like to take this conversation outside?" He shook his head.
"No."
I took a couple of steps toward him, still supporting Albert, narrowing the 40 feet between us. He lifted the lighter toward the cigar.
"I think you better stay there."
I stopped. "Did you kill Clarence Lassbull?" He turned his head and looked at the door to the basement that he'd propped open to allow the gas to filter in.
"He deserved it. He was a disease."
He gestured with the cigar, pointing it at me like a gun.
"He beat her. He beat her, and he hurt my child."
There was a sob in his voice.
"He slept with any woman who would have him. The drugs around the place, it was horrible. My beautiful, strong son living in a place like that."
He lowered the cigar but held the lighter next to his chest. I waited a moment. "Are you planning on taking all of us with you?" He nodded a curt nod.
"That was the idea."
"Was?" He cleared his throat.
"I'm just so tired of all of it."
He looked down the hall.
"Where's Barrett?"
He got out through the old coal chute in the back.
"That's good. I wouldn't want him getting hurt."
I took another step and nodded toward the bottle of liquor on the desk. "So it's just you, me, and Albert here to celebrate?" I could see him swallow as he brought the cigar back up and glanced at the bottle.
"I guess so."
I took a few more steps. "So you're going to kill off the only blood relative Adrian's got?" He paused.
"I don't see any other way out of this."
There isn't any way out of this, but there's a way through it. You killed a man, and you're going to do time. I don't know how much, because that isn't my decision, but you'll be alive and can tell your son what happened. You can tell him about his mother. He nodded, but I could see his face tighten as he coughed. She was a good woman. He stepped to the side and gestured with the cigar again, as if ushering us out of a movie theater. You might as well get out of here, Sheriff. The stairwell is unlocked. That way I can have a last drink and light my cigar. I took a few steps closer. You're sure that's what you want to do? He nodded his head some more, and I got within 20 feet of him before he stuffed the cigar in the corner of his mouth and flipped open the aged Zippo. I'm sure. I looked down and could see the old chief's eyes, dazed but watching us. Albert? The eyes wobbled toward me. Yes? You think you can make it out of the building on your own? He nodded. I think so, but you need to go. I'm just going to stay here for a minute and talk to Herbert. Even with his passive resistance, I ushered him through the side and watched as he carefully made his way through the open doorway toward the exterior door. He pushed on the bar, the door swung wide, and he turned to look at me. I was thankful for the flood of clear air, but it didn't last long, as the heavy door swung back and closed, like a tomb. Casually, Herbert lifted the lighter to the cigar, his thumb on the wheel of the thing, his only souvenir of a long, dead war. He didn't move, but just stood there, with his head dipped, ready to strike. Tell my son that I loved him. Keeping my intentions clear, I turned and folded my arms, leaning my back against the coolness of the corner of the wall behind me. I crossed my boots and stared down at the 6 feet between us as if I had all the time in the world. I brought my face up slowly to look into the one brown eye that was revealed under his hat with the one gray eye under the brim of mine. He still didn't move, but spoke out of the side of his mouth. I'm not bluffing, Sheriff. I know that. I also know that as soon as this propane hits an ignition source, like a water heater or a pilot light, it won't matter who's bluffing. I blew air through my nose in an attempt to drive some of the gas away. You say you're tired and that you've had enough. Well, there's really only one way to end this in a respectable fashion. Give me the lighter. If I was going to make a grab for it, now would have been the time. It was then that there was an incredible clatter behind Herbert from the other end of the hallway. I fully expected the building to go up, but it didn't, and we both stood there as I glanced out the window and saw Barrett Long's truck dragging the doors at the end of a tow strap. I was right. He did figure it out. I was just glad the sparks the metal doors were making on the surface of the parking lot were far away and receding. Our attention was suddenly drawn to the other end of the hall where Lolo Long had thrown herself through the door and had swung both the beam of her maglite and the barrel of that big revolver of hers toward us. Freeze! Police! She was doing better. Herbert backed against the desk and looked at me, his thumb still on the wheel of the Zippo. I shouted as quickly as I could, "Don't shoot! The entire basement is full of propane. One shot and the whole place goes up." She looked uncertain, but continued down the hall toward us with her sidearm and flashlight still pointed toward Herbert. It was only when she was about 20 feet away that she noticed the cigar and, more important, the lighter in his hands. "Holster the weapon, Lolo." She ignored me and gestured at him with the barrel of the Smith. "Drop the lighter." We stood there with her on one side of the stairwell opening, me on the other, and Herbert facing the creeping gas that continued to seep up from the basement. "Chief, holster the weapon." She looked at me for the briefest of seconds, and then did as I'd asked. I took a breath before speaking again, hoping it wasn't my last. "Herbert, I sure would hate to think that after all the places we've been, and all the stuff we've been through, that it would all end like this." After a moment, his eyes turned to mine. I pushed off the wall and stuffed my hands in the pockets of my jeans. You say you're tired. Well, I'm tired, too. I watched as his eyes shifted and he studied the lighter in his hands. My daughter's getting married at Crazy Head Springs in a few days, and I sure would like to be there for that. Just like I think Chief Long here would like to go see her son up in Billings. And I imagine you'd like to be around for Adrian's first birthday, whether it's through plexiglass or not. He didn't move, and I wondered for just the briefest of moments what it would be like to be flash-fried in the instant it would take for him to roll the thumb wheel on the flint and spark the tiniest of flames in the lighter's windscreen. The alarms would clamor, and most likely the building itself would be lifted off its foundation. The sprinklers would come on, but unlike the movies, reality would dictate water pressure, and the tribal headquarters of the Northern Cheyenne would burn again. We would likely never know it or see it. Instead, the force of ignition and instantaneous explosion would carry the three of us through the hallway, through the doors and staircase, and throw us out onto the lawn like pulverized, flame-broiled meat. But I had faith in Herbert, his good horse, the man who had brought so much laughter and goodwill to his fellow man. Considering what it is you're thinking of doing, I have to tell you that I don't see much romance in death. We've seen too much of it. I sighed and continued, figuring that if I was going to die, I was at least going to have my say. I've been in these situations before and can tell you that there's nothing romantic about it, nothing heroic. Dead is just dead. I slowly pulled a single hand from my pocket and held it out to him. Steady there, between us, palm up. What is it that Jimi Hendrix says about love? He kept his eyes on me but didn't move, the words on the lighter pouring out of him like music. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. His thumb relaxed on the wheel of the lighter. Hey, a Native American, First Nations, indigenous person, and a white guy walk into a multicultural drinking establishment? He studied me with a broad smile. You don't like that one? Neither do I. Okay, try this one. Two Indians walk out of a bar. I waited for the punchline with my hand still extended. His smile faded. Hey, it could happen. Epilogue. I stood there in my stiff dress clothes and tried not to scratch as I watched the traditional Cheyenne wedding ceremonial procession approach, replete with mounted retinue and my white buckskin-clad daughter. As father of the bride, I had been offered a traditional outfit of my own, but was having enough trouble with my tuxedo jacket and tie. I stuffed a forefinger into the collar of my dress shirt and pulled it a little looser, trying not to feel like the butler to the Northern Cheyenne tribe. After a moment, I shifted back to twirling my wife's engagement ring on my little finger and felt a sharp jab from an elbow. Stop fidgeting. I spoke to her in a low voice. I can't help it. I think the last time I wore this was at the Wyoming Sheriff's Association ball when I first got elected. I thought sheriffs didn't have balls. Ha ha. I looked down at my undersheriff and sister of the groom. She'd elected to come over to the bride's side because she liked us better. I figured we'd lost you to Nebraska. Fuck that. The formal procession drew near, and Katie was radiant.
She looks great.
I smiled. Yep, she does.
It's nice that she's not showing.
I gave Victoria Moretti a look.
I'm just saying, her eye wandered. Even my two-headed brother looks good.
I studied Michael, who was about to become my son-in-law. He looked a little dazed and confused, kind of the way that other guy did what seemed like a century ago. Granted, Martha and I hadn't had the pomp and circumstance. We'd had only that justice of the peace from Miles City and his wife playing the accordion. But it had been enough to galvanize our lives together. Michael looked like he might run, but there were the three other Moretti brothers to chase him down, and the old man, chief of detectives north, who would likely just put a bullet in his leg and then charge the municipality of Philadelphia for his ammunition. Nina Moretti was lovely, as usual, in a knee-length off-white dress. She was doing her best to look cool and unflappable as her high heels sank into the rich earth of Crazy Head Springs. We had a motley bunch seated on our side of the aisle. My dispatcher, Ruby with Dog, my old boss, Lucian, and a contingency of deputies, Sizer Vittoria, with Marie and Antonio, the Ferg and his wife, and Freimeyer, Double Tough having volunteered to man the desk back at the office. Dorothy, who had made the wedding cake from one of Alphonse's old world recipes, was seated next to Lucian, as were most of the field office of the FBI, including Agent in Charge Cliff Clye, and even a couple of Philadelphia Police Department detectives of our own, Katz and Gowder. Mary Barside was there with Juana and Benjamin, and Omar and Lana and Bill. And, of course, Doc Bloomfield. The Cheyenne chief sat in his wheelchair with Melissa behind him and smiled over the pageantry of the approaching bride. His right-hand man, the Cheyenne Nation, stood a little closer to us on the ceremonial bed of white sage. I repeated to myself over and over, Ehestana nahestona hanotze, Ehestana nahestona hanotze, Ehestana nahestona hanotze. Are you chanting to yourself? I hadn't realized I was mumbling. I'm trying to remember how to say my line. She shook her head and spoke from the side of her mouth. Look, nobody's going to be paying any attention to you, all right? I nodded. She changed the subject, probably hoping to divert my attention. So, KRZZ is looking for a new morning drive guy? I watched as the black horse carrying my daughter crossed the clearing as the other maidens, including Dina Menicamps, followed on their own mounts in single file. I guess so. It turned out the first child that Audrey miscarried was Clarence's, but when he was in Iraq, he got hurt. Vic leaned in. So the one that went over the cliff with his mother? Adrian. Adrian belonged to Herbert his good horse? Yep. Audrey was leaving the res with Clarence and taking Adrian with her. I guess it was more than Herbert could stand. Adrian is the last living heir to his good horse name. What about the nephew in the wheelchair? Carl's name was different, Red Fox, and that's why it didn't ring any bells on the medication listing I got from Lolo Long's mother at health services, at least at first. And the bracelet belonged to Carl? Yep, it belonged to his great-grandfather who fought in France during World War I. Then Herbert used it to put Carl's medication on when he lost his legs in the car crash. After a while, Carl was doing so well that Herbert started wearing the bracelet as a reminder. Audrey must have pulled it off of him when they were struggling. So he was the one who tried to run over you on 212? Yep. And Herbert made the tape from recordings at the tribal offices? Yep. And just filled in the parts he needed Clarence to say by manipulating his own voice. He'd been worried about what Audrey was going to do, and had been taping her for months. And used the old Indian trick of blaming it on the FBI. I shifted my weight. Herbert was a source for the BIA and dropped the tape on them anonymously. The FBI would have figured it out with a little more analysis, but everybody was in a hurry to jail Artie. Well, they must not have taken it too badly since they're in attendance. She glanced at the collected law enforcement, and then over their heads were a small contingency of tribal security, two officers to be exact, stood watch. Is that her? I rested my eyes on the tall woman with the broad shoulders, her hair loose for once, spreading down her back like a luxurious blue-black shawl. I noticed she'd traded in the S&W for a Sig Sauer P229-40, complete with stylish rosewood grips. After a second, the jasper eyes turned and looked back at us, and I could have sworn she'd overheard our conversation from almost 50 feet away. The nearest eyebrow was arched, and her full lips were smiling. My under-sheriff turned her head to look at me. I don't like her. Too bad, you have a lot in common. You think so? I turned and looked at her for a change. I was giving sheriff lessons.
I bet you were. A familiar voice sounded from just behind us.
I hate to break up this lovely conversation, but would you mind going and helping your daughter off the horse so that she can get married?
I glanced back at the Cheyenne Nation, master of ceremonies, my best friend, and the man who was going to actually be marrying my daughter to Michael Moretti.
Estana na hestona hanoce.
He looked at me, blankly. Right? He shrugged and nudged me with a strong hand.
Close enough. Vic added under her breath, You're on.
I started the walk down the aisle between the two families as Ruby, always able to read my moods, stretched a hand out to squeeze mine as I passed in a token of reassurance. There were rows of poles meandering across the meadow and leading into the forest at the head of the valley that led down to the springs. The staffs were festooned with Indian paintbrush and white and pale blue ribbons, the Cheyenne traditional colors, and flittered in the slight breeze. The scent of cedar, sage, and sweet grass filtered through the air as I pulled up at the back of the crowd alongside the tribal police chief and sighed deeply. She glanced at me, still wearing the smile. I don't think your undersheriff likes me.
No, I don't think she does.
I glanced at Lolo Long.
You mind telling me something?
What?
What is it you've got against Henry?
She looked uncomfortable, and I was almost sorry I'd asked. Nothing big, she paused. I had this huge crush on him when I was a kid, and he never gave me the time of day. He even dated my mom.
I glanced at her.
There was a time when my mother was rather hot.
I don't doubt it.
I played with the ring on my little finger.
Where is your mother?
In Billings, making arrangements to adopt Adrian. There was no other time or she would be here. I'm supposed to go up there after the ceremony. I leaned a little forward and watched as Albert Blackhorse, in full tribal police uniform, did his best to ignore us and watch my daughter approach.
Well, you've got good help these days.
I listened as the Four Dances drum group beat in time to the horses walking down the pathway.
Ehestana na hestona hanoce. Ehestana na hestona hanoce. Ehestana na hestona hanoce.
I might try and visit my son while I'm up there.
I nodded my head and then realized what she said and smiled back at her.
Nothing big, just touching base, you know. Get things started.
I think that's a great idea.
She waited a moment before speaking again, and I could tell it was still hard for her. If I haven't mentioned it...
You have.
She leaned a shoulder into my arm and bumped me.
And that was enough.
The black mare made the last turn in the path, and I could now see that its mane was braided like Katie's hair.
You know, it was something you said that jogged my memory loose about the connection between Herbert and Carl and the bracelet. When you were getting ready to head off, you said something about the family stuff being more than you wanted to handle. And it got me thinking.
You're being kind.
I'm being honest.
I took a breath and repeated my line, careful to not speak out loud this time. You'd be very proud of me, Walt. I wrote up a very nice report explaining to the DOJ that Special Agent Cly was instrumental in breaking the case and that I was looking forward to working with him in the future. I nodded.
You're trying to get rid of him.
Just as fast as paperwork can travel. Breathing a laugh, I glanced back at the AIC and he raised his eyebrows at me. My attention was drawn to the sky as two large, dark birds circled each other, and I quietly prayed that they weren't turkey vultures. I looked at Lolo.
So, are you going to keep the job?
There was a long pause as she thought about it. For a while. See if it suits me. I reached out and bumped the extra mags on her gun belt with the back of my hand as I stepped forward.
It does.
Katie had pulled Wahoo Sue up to the assigned spot.
She was an admirable horsewoman, but working without a saddle or bridle was always a trick. I raised my hands up to her, took her by the waist, and gently lowered her to the ground. She looked up at me and grinned, and I don't think I'd ever seen her so beautiful. She spoke in a whisper as her hand crept up and stroked the big horse to quiet her.
"So far, so good."
"Better than the wedding march on an accordion, I can tell you that." I took her hand and we turned toward the altar, a little time to spare as the menfolk answered Henry's questions and got themselves together. "You look marvelous."
"Thank you. You look pretty spiffy yourself."
"Spiffy, huh?" She hugged my arm.
"Yeah."
"I seem to recall that as one of your mother's words."
"It was."
She hugged my arm tighter, and we both took a deep breath.
"I wish she was here."
"Me too." I cleared my throat and remembered the ring. "I've got something to give you." She glanced at me, a trace of annoyance in her voice.
"Now?"
"Well, yep. Here in a couple of minutes, it'll be too late." I placed my fingers around the ring on my little finger and pulled. There was a slight panic when it felt as if I might not be able to get it over the knuckle, but after the second try it came free. I handed it to my daughter. She took it, staring at the smallish diamond surrounded by two chips, one on either side of the antique setting. "It belonged to your great-great-grandmother. I gave it to your mother as an engagement ring when we got married, but she made me take it back for you when she... when..." I took another breath, knowing our time was running out. Toward the end. She looked up at me through the wayward strands of strawberry blonde, her eyes shining. "She wanted you to have it." She swallowed and slipped the ring onto the same finger as the engagement ring that Michael had given her. The dichotomy between the sizes of the two stones almost laughable. In 1863, that was a big diamond. She laughed and cut the circulation off in my arm.
"It's all going to be all right."
Her clear gray eyes came up to mine.
"Right?"
"Right." Henry Standingbear gestured toward the small Longmire family, the fringe under the arm of his outstretched sleeve swaying with the light breeze. We started down the aisle and toward the waiting Moretti's. For a second I was reminded of something a friend had said, something on the mountain, something ominous. But I pushed that from my mind and looked up to see that the two birds I'd noticed were crows, circling right above the meadow, the pin feathers of their wing tips spread like fingers as they rode the thermals that lifted them into the cloudless sky. Maybe it was an omen, but I decided to take it as a good one. I'd heard that crows mate for life and are known to raise their young for as long as 5 years. Sometimes you don't get that long. I thought about Audrey Plainfeather and how her life hadn't turned out the way she'd hoped. Maybe nobody's did. My wife Martha's hadn't. Mine hadn't. Even Henry's hadn't. Maybe Katie's would. It's hopes like this that you cling to at major turning points in your life. And more important, the lives of your children. You keep going and you hope for the best, and sometimes, maybe not very often, your hopes come true. I took the luxury of watching the crows playing tag above our heads for a moment more, the graceful arc of their patterns intertwining in figure eights of infinity. That was probably our job here, to keep going and to do it with as much artistry and beauty as our hearts could bear. Henry was talking to me when I lowered my face. I hadn't caught what he'd said, and it wouldn't have made any difference if I had, because I wouldn't have understood it. But I looked down at the young woman on my arm. All my dreams and hopes bundled together in one achingly beautiful woman. I turned to my friend and the world, and the words poured from me like a fervent prayer. Ehestana na hestona hanotse.
The End. You've been listening to As the Crow Flies by Craig Johnson, narrated by George Guidel, and directed by Angel Morality Dotson. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Deed to Death by D.B. Henson, narrated by Kate Forbes. At 29, Tony Matthews is on the cusp of having it all. A successful career as one of Nashville's top real estate agents, great friends, and the partner and family she'd always longed for in her fiancé, Scott, a successful architect. But just days before their planned nuptials, Scott plummets to his death at one of his construction sites, and Tony is forced to bury him on their wedding day. Now, living all alone in their new custom-made dream house, dealing with her loss becomes even harder when the police rule his death a suicide. As she crisscrosses Nashville on a mission to prove to herself and the world that Scott wouldn't try to escape this life, her determined search for the truth turns out to have deadly consequences. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So visit us at recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.